Welcome to Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone. I am joined by Dr. Michael Reckenwald, a former professor at New York University. He is the author of 12 books, including Google Archipelago, The Digital Gulag, and The Simulation of Freedom, and The Great Reset and the Struggle for Liberty, Unraveling the Global Agenda. He is also running for president as a member of the Libertarian Party. Dr. Reckenwald, where is the best place for people to find out more about your campaign and where you stand on the issues?
It's the best place is to go to wrecktheregime.com. That's R-E-C, theregime.com.
Excellent. Links to that will be in the description below. So originally, I had supported Robert F. Kennedy for president. And then, little did I know, a member of the Mises Institute would actually enter the race. Robert F. Kennedy since then has come out as a racist who actively supports affirmative action, has justified the mass murder of civilians in Gaza as well as the West Bank. So he was kicked off my list. I was looking for someone to endorse, and I have chosen to endorse Dr. Michael Reckenwald because of his understanding of the Marxist versus Austrian class analysis. Mr. Reckenwald, when you run for president, what is going to be the main theme of your candidacy?
Well, the main theme of the candidacy is that this is a campaign, but it's more than a campaign. It's a movement to educate people on what libertarianism is, what liberty is, to change the culture at large, because we can't change people's political views without changing culture and getting cultural values shifted. And finally, is to lead this movement of Project Decentralization, the localization, decentralization, nullification strategy, to gain power, to wrest power from the central government, and to vest it in the people at the local level.
Excellent. I am looking forward to your campaign. I am happily endorsing you for president. What I wanted to do was have you and I go over one of the central things that took us from being left-wing progressives to libertarians. And it was actually, for me, primarily this article. This is from Dr. Hans Hoppe. It is titled Marxist and Austrian Class Analysis. Before getting into the 5 points that Hans Hoppe makes here, can you please define what communism and Marxism is for us?
Oh, sure. Communism or Marxism is the belief or the theory that the worker is exploited at the point of production, and likewise, this surplus value is extracted. Every worker is effectively robbed when they go to work every day. In fact, they only get paid, you know, half of the time that they work. That half of the time that they work is exploited. It's surplus value that's skimmed off and goes into the capitalist's coffers. And the idea is that this creates a class struggle between the proletariat and the ruling class, which in his reading is the capitalist class. And history is the history of this class struggle. And the only way to end this exploitation and class struggle is by the working class to finally wrest power from the capitalist class and to take over the means of production. And likewise, there'll be no more exploitation, and there'll be this socialist society that morphs into communism over time after, in fact, the dictator of the proletariat is established. And then finally, there is a full communism. And that means no property is owned by anybody. Supposedly, there's a collective ownership of the means of production and likewise of all products. It is very seductive for people that don't think it through long enough or mistake the class structure as Marx does. It's a seductive theory. It duped me for a good while. I actually believed that I had this firm hatred for capitalism and the capitalist class. And I thought that as long as the workers were exploited, we would not have a just society.
Thank you so much for building that bridge between the worker is exploited, therefore the abolition of private property needs to take place. This is how Marx and Engels summarized it in the manifesto. The communist position can be summarized as abolition of property or abolition of bourgeois property. So thank you so much for squaring that circle for us as close as we can come to understanding it. So here is how Hans Hoppe analyzes this. He says... So I'm going to read this off. I want you to tell me what is right and what is wrong with this.
Okay.
First point of the Marxist theory of history. The history of mankind is the history of class struggles. It is the history of struggles between a relatively small ruling class and a larger class of the exploited. The primary form of exploitation is economic. The ruling class expropriates part of the productive output of the exploited, or, as Marxists say, it appropriates a social surplus product and uses it for its own consumptive purposes. What is right about that and what is wrong about that?
Well, as stated, it's actually, there's nothing wrong with it. It's actually correct. This, if just in those terms, as it's put there, and these abstract terms, this is true. There is a ruling class. It does exploit the majority. It is a minority. It is taking what is not its own. It is appropriating from the worker, or not the worker, from the person. Let's just put it that way, from the subject. And it is robbery. And it is an established class that has a kind of organization, and it has a means of justifying itself. And we can talk about that further. But that, in sum, that is correct as such.
Point number two. The ruling class is unified by its common interest in upholding the exploitative position and maximizing its exploitatively appropriated surplus product. It never deliberately gives up power or exploitative income. Instead, any losses in power or income must be wrestled away from it through struggles whose outcome ultimately depends on the class consciousness of the exploited, i.e., on whether or not and to what extent the exploited are aware of their own status and are consciously united with other class members in common opposition to exploitation. What is right about that, and what, if anything, is wrong?
Okay, that's a great way of putting it, that Hans Hermann Hoppe is brilliant here, what he's doing. I mean, it's, again, this is effectively right. There's some things that are missing from this picture. There's competition within this class, this ruling class. It is not homogeneous. There are distinct players that compete with each other. And for example, there's competition between these rulers for who actually gets to be the expropriator at the time. And then I would say there's another thing that's somewhat misleading is the collectivism that it implies in attempting to wrest power away from this ruling class. It is a collectivist project here, as it's stated, and I don't think that's correct necessarily. It isn't necessary to be a collectivist body opposing the ruling class as such. I think the class consciousness aspect of it is correct. We have to have class consciousness in order to see this exploitation, in order to understand ourselves as exploited, and in order to do something about it. But whether this takes a collectivism, which is essentially leftist and Marxist, really, in orientation, that's another matter. We can talk about that further.
So when it comes to the ruling class, the Marxists will say that the bosses or the bourgeoisie, they will sometimes say that this can take form in the place of politics as well, but it's mainly in the commercial realm, which is why Hans Hoppe says it's mostly an economic source of exploitation. So who are they saying the exploiters are, and who are the real exploiters?
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I mean, they're saying that the exploiters are the capitalist class. That is, those who own the means of production, and they are exploiting the workers at the point of production every day, day in and day out. And they're siphoning off this surplus value. And of course, this is all premised now on the labor theory of value, which Hermann Hoppe will talk about soon after this. And that's, of course, he's not telling you that here, but that's the truth. And once that theory falls, the whole edifice of Marxism actually tumbles right after it. There goes the theory of exploitation. There goes the whole reason for Marxism.
So as far as class consciousness, who is... So many of these issues are very complex, but it's not the complexity which really draws people in. It's finding villains to hate and people to really admire and people to be on the same team as. So give us an example of a justifiable divide within the economic realm that isn't black versus white, rich versus poor, or man versus woman.
A justifiable divide is that there will be unequal outcomes in a capitalist society or in any really free market society where there's free exchange of goods, where people take their own property in themselves and the property they've homesteaded to the marketplace. Some people will do better than others. The biggest red herring of leftism is this idea of income inequality. This is not something to be dreaded, or it's not the horror that they make it out to be. There's certainly nothing wrong with income inequality. It doesn't mean that some people are consigned forever to poverty. It doesn't mean that at all. It just means that some players will have wares, whether they're personal wares in their mental or physical capabilities, and they will have work ethics that are different than others, and they'll have a degree of good fortune. Some people just have good fortune, and this will leave some people with more than other people. But that's not the horror show that the left and Marxism makes it out to be. Now, you did ask, and I didn't answer, who is the real exploitative class? It is not the capitalist class, per se, at all. It is the state. The state is the only institution, as he points out later, that takes wealth, wrestles it away from the subject, let's put it that way, against his will, without a contract, and by coercion. The state is a band of robbers and murderers, but that's another point. It's a band of robbers, murderers, and usually liars as well. It is not the capitalist class, because the whole theory on which this idea of Marxist exploitation is premised is false. The labor theory of value is invalid. It is not really what's happening at all. As Hans points out later, it's a difference in time preference. The worker needs to have his pay or her pay before the capitalist needs their return on investment. Now, that's basically the difference, why there's a distinction between what a product is sold for and what the sum total that laborers are paid.
When it comes to the contract contradiction within Marxism, it's unbelievable. You have agreements between employers and employees, and this is seen as completely illegitimate because there's a power differential. However, they embrace, generally, people like Nina Turner, people like Jimmy Dore and Cenk Uygur, all explicitly say there is a justifiable contract, and that's the social contract. So a legitimate contract is you living within a geographical area that the state claims to rule over, but not a legitimate contract is one you choose to operate in by engaging in with mutually beneficial voluntary exchanges. So how is it that they're able to advocate such a blatant non sequitur that genuine contracts are not contracts, but real contracts are mythical social contracts? Please walk us through that.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the social contract is a contract that's not explicit, and that I don't think anybody ever signed. It's never been signed, and it's just an supposed implicit contract between you and the state. And so how they get there is this. What it is they see the state as the benevolent actor that comes in and that addresses the income inequality gap. And so therefore the state is legitimate, because it has this benevolent character. It is the only entity that can arbitrate between the so-called exploited workers and the capitalists. That's what they see the state as. It's kind of like this, it's an arbitrator between labor and capital. Now, a lot of people on the left don't have this explicitly in mind, but as I've argued elsewhere, and they're unconscious Marxists all over. There are more unconscious Marxists than there are conscious Marxists. They don't really understand that these are the premises that they're operating from, but that is, these are the implicit premises that they accept. They think that only the state can rectify this inequity between labor and capital.
Another thing about inequality is they will say that inequality is the result of, you know, too many free market exchanges, too much private property, too much voluntary exchange. However, we see the most amount of inequality in the political realm, whether it's in a relatively free country like Sweden, Denmark, or America, or Canada, or places like North Korea and Venezuela. How is it that they've been able to take inequality, something that will always exist everywhere since the days of Aristotle, and pin it uniquely on the free market?
Yeah, because they see the free market as necessarily tending towards inequality because of this premise of exploitation that they hold. Whether they, you know, really understand that that's what their premises are, they nevertheless implicitly endorse those premises without really considering the possibility that they're absolutely wrong. And so instead of seeing the state as the arbitrary imposition of exploitation as actually the only entity that wrests money from you, that wrests your labor from you, really, if you want to go into Marxist territory, that exploits your labor for its own benefit without any agreement. And so instead of seeing explicit contracts to which workers agree as, in fact, legitimate, they deem these illegitimate because they're based on some sort of ledger domain that they assume must subsist in this contract. But, you know, why would workers enter into such a contract if, in fact, it was so nefarious, if it was so against their interests?
Excellent points. Let's go on to point number 3 out of 5. Class rule manifests itself primarily in specific arrangements regarding the assignment of property rights, or in Marxist terminology, in specific relations of production. Mm-hmm. In order to protect these arrangements or production relations, the ruling class forms and is in command of the state as the apparatus of compulsion and coercion. The state enforces and helps reproduce a given class structure through the administration of a system of class justice, and it assists in the creation and the support of an ideological superstructure designed to lend legitimacy to the existence of class rule. What is wrong with that? What is right with that? What is the incorrect premise?
Okay, well, in a sense, when you gloss it as it stands, there's nothing really wrong with it, except this idea that what they're saying is that what the Marxists assume is that the state is always the weapon or the instrument of the ruling class, which exists prior to the state. So the state, under Marxist ideas, is just something that the ruling class has command over because of their wealth. And this is completely mistaken. The state, the state doesn't exist simply because, or isn't something that the ruling class merely uses as an instrument. Rather, the state is the very essence of ruling class positionality, and that is to say, there wouldn't be a ruling class without the state at all. So they see that the ruling class already exists prior to the existence of a state, and that all you need to do is get rid of the, not the state, but get rid of the ruling class, and then you have no exploitation. But it's quite the opposite. The inverse of the case is true. The only reason you have exploitation is because the state exists, not because somebody captures it.
So this sentence right here, it assists in the creation and the support of an ideological superstructure. As the author of The Great Reset and Google Archipelago, and someone who understands state education because you were a professor at NYU, give us an example of how the ideological superstructure of the state exists and what people need to understand to see through its propaganda.
Yeah, so, I mean, what the state does is, of course, just about every professor in most universities, let's just take the United States as a limited case, They're all really state agents. They're actually all working for the state, and that's because the state is really what's supporting them. I mean, if it weren't for student aid and loans and the whole nine yards and government grants and all that, these institutions, first of all, they wouldn't be so numerous. There wouldn't be so many employees of these universities. There wouldn't be these, what Hans calls in another essay, intellectual bodyguards for the state. That's exactly what they are. So what they're doing is, and it's very ironic, Keith, because in many cases, or I should say in almost all cases, these people who are intellectual bodyguards for the state deem themselves, they think of themselves as radicals, as people that are opposing the system. But the fact of the matter is they're actually the foot soldiers of the system. They're perfectly in line with the system, because what they are arguing for is statism, and they're using any number of ideologies to support statism. Marxism is one. Postmodernism is another. Feminism another. Basically, the whole DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion regime is premised on the state intervening in social relations to make sure that those social relations are equitable and that they include such and such players who are otherwise deemed excluded by virtue of their diversity. So the state is deemed by them as the instrument to rectify all this. And this is why they promote DEI. This is why they promote feminism. Feminism is the same sort of system that is effectively saying, look, there's this inequitable relations between men and women. This is historically the case. It's patriarchy. It must be overthrown. And who can do that but the state? So they inadvertently support, they're duped, they inadvertently support the very structures of exploitation that they think they are opposing.
That is a vitally important point that was pointed out to me some time ago when, let's say that social justice advocates are the kindest people on planet Earth. They are still advocating a system which will attract, like a bat signal, the most evil people to a very powerful state. So if you have a bad person, you would want them in the voluntary sector where they can't take a penny out of your pocket or get a second out of your time unless they do so voluntarily. Right. I'm sure Vanderbilt, Carnegie, and Rockefeller might have been terrible people, but we would want terrible people in the voluntary sector. Whereas right. The social justice advocate is drastically increasing the profitability of bad people to, create injustice by occupying the state they wish to see so powerful in the first place. So even if we make AOC queen of the United Nations and we have a one world Marxist state, we don't know who is going to be attracted to that position after AOC, not to mention the fact that AOC today has more institutional unequal power than 99.9% of her supporters ever right. will. So it's a complete fool's errand to think that equality is something achievable.
Right.
But when it comes to the unintended consequences of increasing state power, what do people need to know?
Well, they need to know that what you give to the state by increasing its power, even if it's in distribution of resources between different parties that are under state subjection, what you do is you actually grow the state and you make it more powerful and more capable of exploitation. So, and this is why, like, the welfare state is often paired with the warfare state. They both increase the size of the state. In the case of the welfare state, it ingratiates a certain segment of the population to the state. And then those particular subjects are most prone to go along with the state's other exploitative and deadly activities like war. So
there. Oh, yeah. Yes. I'm sorry.
No, that's it. That's fine for right there.
So there is a general theory referred to as the Iron Law of Oligarchy. I want to read the summary, and I would like your response to what the implications are of this idea. It states that all complex organizations, regardless of how democratic they are when started, eventually develop into oligarchies, since no one since no sufficiently large and complex organization can function purely as a direct democracy, power within an organization will always get delegated to individuals within that group, elected or otherwise.
Yes, I mean, this is true. We have an, we're going to have elites. And so to condemn elites per se is really mistaken. There will be elites because there will be people that separate themselves out from the rest by virtue of their abilities, their ambition, and you know, many other factors. Sometimes it comes from, it comes from history. Let's be real, that there is some degree of, you gain elite status by virtue of birth in some cases. Many of those people squander that and end up as socialists, for example, like Elon Musk's, I think his daughter is a socialist, a Marxist. And there's always going to be a natural elite, but there sometimes is, you know, an exchange of elites, that there is a rotation amongst elite groups. So there's nothing endemically wrong about elites per se. The question is whether they are part of the exploitative class of the state or one of its beneficiaries or enablers. Because the state, I think, isn't just the government per se. The state, and this is where people get kind of confused, and I think they start, in some cases, and I won't say who here, they start to get lost and they start really drifting back to a Marxist analysis. The only corporations that are exploitative are those that are in collusion with the state, that have some, that are beneficiaries of it and serve as agents of it in some cases, to undertake state functions, and they're effectively state apparatuses. I've called them governmentalities to make sense of that. That's a term that I coined in this context, but it actually came out of postmodern theory. Michel Foucault, who used it in an entirely different way. But there's some aspects of what he said that are actually true. That governmentality is like governmentality. That is the mentality that the government actually propagates. So there's that part. But it's very, very easy for people to get confused and start drifting back into for the first time Marxist style analysis when they see corporations per se, big corporations, as endemically evil because they're large and successful. That's a mistake. The question is whether they're part of the state apparatus or not, whether they're beneficiaries of the state, whether they're getting monopoly status through regulations and other means.
Okay, so we recognize that elites are a constant throughout history. Yeah. Genghis Khan, Aristotle, Chairman Mao. I mean, just every society you find some people have a totally disproportionate amount of power.
Yeah.
In America, let's just take the West today. So let's take America to Ukraine. Let's include them. do we see any aspect of non-elites in any realm? Like in basketball, there's elites. In music, there's elites.
Right.
So why we wouldn't think that elite idea would also extend to the genius of how to arrange productive capacities within the employment and commercial realm is just bizarre. So not only do I not see tons of examples of, well, there's a lot of, I don't see one example of this equality that they're searching for. Have you ever found one?
No, there's actually no equality. The only way you can attempt to get equality is by smashing people. It's kind of the Harrison Bergeson routine from Kurt Vonnegut. You have to cut people's legs out from under them, and it never works, even if you try. So yeah, there's no way to reach equality. It's a myth. Equality is the enemy of liberty, because to aim at equality, which is, you know, this utopian ideal, you must abrogate the rights and property rights of other people.
Now, what about, would you agree with me that libertarianism is really the only genuine movement for equality, as in we believe in a genuine equality of rights and don't have some double standard for a group of people called Congress or police or the state?
Exactly. There's no double standard in terms of where people are able to go and get. And there's no double standard because there's no entrenched establishment elites that, regardless of how capable they are are buttressed by this state power and likewise can wield it over us without any really without merit. This is the state is actually kind of like a congealment of illegitimate power and that assumes an elite status when really it doesn't exist in the real competitive world. So it is a way of actually buttressing and supporting and, you know, congealing power in a particular elite that has no accomplishments as such, that is nothing but an exploitative elite and not a natural elite.
Point number four in Marx's First Austrian Class Analysis. Internally, the process of competition within the ruling class generates a tendency toward increasing concentration and centralization. A multipolar system of exploitation is gradually supplanted by an oligarchic or monopolistic one. Fewer and fewer exploitation centers remain in operation, and those that do are increasingly integrated into a hierarchical order. And externally, example, within the international system, this internal centralization process will, the more intensely and more advanced it is, lead to imperialist interstate wars and the territorial expansion of exploitative rule. What do we need to understand about that section?
Well, this is great. I mean, when you're saying this and understanding it in terms of Marxism, what Marx was referring to is the tendency he saw for capitalism to lead to monopolies, and then for them to use the state as a weapon to gain further territorial territories to exploit, whether it be what they called primitive accumulation, which means just basically ransacking different continents for goods and labor, or whether it's through setting up new centers of exploitation in different parts of the world. That would be imperialism for the Marxist. Really, but this statement is so true on another entirely different interpretation. And that is, yes, states tend towards increasing centralization and concentration of power. And that there is a tendency for states to gain monopolistic power, of course. They already have monopolistic power, but to extend their monopolies further and further. And eventually, as he says here, the centralization leads to imperialist state wars. Absolutely the case. There are wars between imperialist nations and between imperialist nations and those other states that they are attempting to supplant or appropriate. So, yes, there's a tendency towards what I call globalism, actually. And Hans actually agrees with this, that there's this tendency towards governments to become singular because one absorbs the other by defeating it, and then you get to this global world order. And this is what I was writing about in The Great Reset and the Struggle for Liberty.
So we have another constant, which is people want more power. But the difference is, in the market, you actually have competition and the freedom to disassociate with bad actors with your time and money.
Right.
So, yeah, we both always will have people who want more power, more influence, and increase in social status. But the market allows for there to be competitors who you can opt out of funding and use alternatives. So, whereas the state does not allow for such a thing. When it comes to, oh, yes, please.
One thing I would add here is that in terms of monopolies, too, as Rothbard points out in his book, The Progressive Era, there were attempts to monopolize outside of the state's aid and its impositions and interventions, and they failed in the late 19th and early 20th century. And this is why these would-be monopolists finally turned to the state for it to actually intervene and help them establish monopolies, which they did. And through a very tricky ledger domain in which they made their interventions look like they were actually, busting monopolies and, with antitrust law and all this, but really, and regulations. But really, these regulations served to, of course, make higher the price of admission or entry and keep competitors out of the marketplace. So everything that they say is the inverse of the truth.
When it comes to the concept of imperialist wars, it is just shocking that the Marxists completely doesn't bring into their analysis the double standards that people have for the state. The state can collect money coercively, which makes it more likely to fund wars that people otherwise wouldn't support. They often have the right to conscript, as Vladimir Zelensky and Vladimir Putin currently do, as Benjamin Netanyahu does. They don't mention central banking. So the ability to print money out of thin air and fund wars, well, that's got nothing to do with making war more likely. They have a compulsory education system, which is a he who pays the piper calls the tune. The state pays the teachers. Of course, the teachers are going to support the wars and justify them. Or even when they don't explicitly justify them, in the case of Iraq and Afghanistan, they'll call them blunders that weren't really in the national interest. They'll never say they're evil mass murder campaigns based on lies. And and then finally, there's the legal double standard. I believe it was August 29th of 2021. Joe Biden authorized a strike in Kabul, Afghanistan, which murdered 7 children and 3 adult civilians. And there was never a discussion like, oh, you think Joe Biden's going to go to jail for this? It's like there's a blatant double standard that the monopolized court system of the state is obviously not going to enforce this. So all the Marxist says is the problem is profit. When it comes to that criticism, that war is about profit, profit is about capitalism, therefore war is the fault of capitalism. What, if anything, is wrong with that analysis?
Well, yeah, that's great. By the way, you're just encyclopedic with these points. I really admit, I really admire and appreciate it. Let me just say that they, you know, they ignore the main monopoly of all. And this is the monopoly over force that the state arrogates to itself. And the state is the only entity that can do things to other people that you and I can't ever get away with, and we shouldn't get away with. And that is not only, you know, expropriating their wealth, but killing them with impunity. And the state doesn't have to live up to the standards that the other, that, you know, otherwise, you know, non-aggressive people have to abide by. And they should abide by it. The state has an exemption. It's the only monopoly in, you know, it's the only real monopoly that exists. Well, there's the banking monopoly as well. And that's another thing they miss. But I would go further that they actually advocated for central banking. Marx's, one of Marx's 10 prongs in the way, in the path to socialism included establishing a central bank. And that bank would give money exclusively to the state industries. So they have no problem with monopolies when it's the state and central banking. It's incredible. And they don't see that it isn't, you know, Coca-Cola isn't running around killing people with impunity. It is not conscripting people to service that they don't want or necessarily abide by, that they have no choice in the matter. In the case of Israel, they make a big deal out of the fact that they also conscript women. Well, congratulations. Let's make it equal opportunity conscription for all. Let's make it, you know, let's universalize our ability to control people against their will and put them in wars and in the service of the state and other ways.
Well, therein lies the social justice issue with the idea. So when we see military conscription or we see forced cotton picking, we will say things like, well, from the libertarian standpoint, if you can't either persuade them to do it voluntarily, pay them in exchange for it, create some sort of other value to get it voluntarily, you don't have the right to force someone to do something against their will. So that's why we're against, you know, forced cotton picking. But they look at forced cotton picking and they say, the problem is we had a white person and a black person. So we're going to focus on the race of these people. We're also going to focus on the gender of everyone with regard to any disparity that might exist. So when it comes to, you know, military conscription, if it's men only, the solution is not to abolish forced labor. It's to also include women. I asked Cenk Uygur who has 6.4 billion views on YouTube, very unequal to my channel, by the way. He is a progressive, said, well, yeah, everyone should be forced to join into a war, you know, because we can't have some people sit back on. Well, so all the farmers and no food is produced. Everyone's in the war. He goes, okay, well, just some people. And I go, well, right now, the Selective Services only men ages 18 to 26. Would you include women too? And he goes, well, yeah, I guess so. And the fact that he said, well, it just shows that he hasn't thought about this even while a third world war is being provoked with Iran, Russia, and China at this very moment. They never look at the implications of their very ideas. So, yeah, that's another social justice shortcoming.
Oh, yeah. Social justice is complicit in state actions, in state murder, in state exploitation, and state conscription, and forced labor, and all that. And all of that is excused. In fact, it's exonerated and even glorified because the state, as I said, really, it goes back to this idea that the state is the arbiter between capital and labor. And they think that, you know, as long as there's capital and labor and there's this inequity that has to be addressed, there's got to be an entity to do that. And that's the state. And then the state can also be an entity that arbitrates between different nations and the inequities between them. And it must intervene in those. And in the case of the United States, it's intervening in Ukraine and in Israel and Gaza and even Taiwan, sending arms there, sending military aid at least, and probably arms as well. It's astounding.
Point number five, with the centralization and expansion of exploitative rule gradually approaching its ultimate limit of world domination, class rule will increasingly become incompatible with the further development and improvement of productive forces. Economic stagnation and crises become more and more characteristic and create the objective conditions for the emergence of a revolutionary class consciousness of the exploited. The situation becomes ripe for the establishment of a classless society. The withering away of the state, the replacement of government of men over men by the administration of things, and as a result, unheard of economic prosperity. What do we need to know about Hoppe's fifth and final point regarding the Marxist theory of history?
Well, I mean, this is beautiful because the way he puts it, it works for both. But it works for the, can you put that back up so I can see it? I'm sorry. Is that possible? Yeah.
Yep.
So this is actually the case that the centralization of the state does lead to, does start to reach the limit of world domination. And what happens when you have a singular one world government? That state can be intensified, its exploitation of the subject. It can tax them even more ruthlessly. It can get them to do whatever they want them to do. It can force them to have a digital identity and participate in a central bank digital currency. It can, and then it starts to erode at the capital base that it's thriving on. And let's not forget, the state is a parasitic organ. So it's a parasitic animal that lives off of capital and sucks it dry at some points, such that its very host keels over and dies. This is what happens when the state expands so far as to become nearly a world system. When it's a world system, it is then utterly exploitative and utterly oppressive. And because as Hoppe points out in another text, there's no outside of it at this point. You can't just move to a different, less exploitative area with a different state. There's nowhere to go. And I've actually had arguments with people that think, oh, one world government's good because then we only have to topple one government rather than many. And this is so funny. And it's so off base. It's hard to believe that people actually think that, but they do. They think that, you know, instead of having, as Hoppe put it, 1,000 Liechtensteins, they think that one world government is the real way to get to equity, to get to a classless society. And so here, what Marxism means by classless society is, of course, a world where there's no workers or the exploited and no capitalist class or the exploiters. But what Hoppe really, in the other interpretation here, the Austrian interpretation, is that there is a classless society because the only two classes that exist are the state and everybody else. So once you get rid of the state, then you do have a classless society. And that means not equality. It just means that there's no class warfare anymore. There's no class that isn't that is endemically exploitative and that is intrinsically evil and that is intrinsically opposed to the interests of those subjects under it.
So one of the ways we can refute the Marxist position of who the exploiters are if you could please give us an examples of non-elite exploiters. Give me an example of, okay, the state's the exploiter because it appropriates resources in the absence of consent or through the homesteading principle. Mm-hmm. Can you give me an example of non-elite exploiters?
Non-elite exploiters? Yeah, I mean, anybody like a thief on the street is effectively a non-elite exploiter. The meter maid who writes tickets on your car for being parked too long in a certain spot. Now, that person's actually just acting as an agent of the state, but they're an exploiter in the sense that they're doing the state's bidding. So these kinds of activities, and this is why I've always talked about the idea that you can't really point to the state as this discrete entity like it's an object. It has tentacles that go all over the place, and it enlists people into itself. It enrolls the public into its own body and makes state agents out of people. We saw this during COVID, and I hope you don't mind my a little bit of a foray here into a topical area, but we saw how the COVID regime enlisted these people to become like the state agents by people running around telling you to get your mask on, yelling at you, telling you to get 6 feet away from them, shaming you and claiming that they will let you, they'd rather see you die if you don't, if you wanted to go to the hospital and if you have not been vaccinated. And then, we saw the way that Big Pharma acted as a state agent aid the state in its extension of coercion over the public in exchange for the monopoly that it got over the vaccines. It gave the state increased powers of coercion. So anybody that steals from me on the street is an exploiter. Anybody that robs me, anybody that takes anything of my property without consent is an exploiter. And they don't necessarily have to be elite at all.
This is why it was so difficult for the MAGA right and the Marxists, who sort of had like a minor alignment where they had said, yeah, we support Trump because Trump is anti-elite. He's anti-establishment.
Yeah.
And then you see BLM rioting and destroying the lives of tens of thousands of people, businesses that took decades to build, people who have put everything into their house and no longer have a genuine sense of security. The Marxists are like, yep, well, they're not the elite, so there's nothing wrong with this. Whereas they're like, well, that still feels like if there's ever some sort of form of exploitation, I work to build this business in this house, and then a group of scumbags who are mad at Derek Chauvin and the police burn my house down. It's like, seems like quite the exploiter.
And the houses of other Black people. And they they shot and murdered Black people. They shot and murdered Black different Black people. They murdered, I don't think it was 39 people overall that can be attributed to the Black Lives Matter riots. And they stole, they continue to steal, and they burned down property. They actually are, and they're not elites. Now, I would go a little bit further than this by saying that I do think, in fact, that these people are the foot soldiers of an elite that wants them to do this. But we'll leave that at that.
Yes, well, certainly Hannah Nicole Jones and Matthew Desmond of the 1619 Project would be considered elites. But we still have to be able to say, anytime someone does something, you can't point to the elites. But the problem with this Marxist theory is, what is their general theory as to why a poor rapist is a bad person or a poor murderer? They're not part of the elites. They're part of the working class, which you need to unite with. all of these things are totally unjustifiable. The libertarian, of course, has the non-aggression principle and an answer for this. But just criticizing elites means poor murderers, poor rapists, poor kidnappers. We got to be friends with all these people, including poor rioters. So
now, what Marxism did with that class of people is they lumped them into this group called the lumpenproletariat, which they deemed to be useless for the purposes of revolution. So they took all these miscreants and they said, well, this is a separate class of people. They couldn't account for it. That's the problem. So this is a separate class of people. Let's call them lumpenproletariat. They're useless scumbags that steal, rob, and rape people. They don't do us any good. Now, the left has softened that view of late, and they see them as victims. So that's everybody's a victim that's not a capitalist. Or part of the so-called elite.
Now let's look at the other side of this equation when it comes to falsifying the Marxist view. Give me an example of a beneficial elite in any realm of society.
Any entrepreneur that creates value in the marketplace and adds a new innovation to our lives is an elite that is actually good for the society. And we should not thwart the activities of these people because they end up increasing our wealth. They increase, they improve the lifestyles and increase the wealth of all of us. There are different elements here. In today's world, it's hard to find a pure elite that's not affiliated with the state somehow. You know, you could take, like, say, Elon Musk. He in some senses is a natural elite, but in another sense, he's not, because he got a lot of subsidies for these EVs, and this certainly government subsidies, and this certainly buttressed his wealth. So I it's real hard to find a natural elite, but I do think they exist. It's just that we don't hear about them as much, because they're vilified in some way.
Just the fact that they can have some collusion with the government, anyone who's ever received unemployment benefits, food stamps, or any welfare recipient, well, then that would make, you know, them part of, the state as well. There are some degrees where, just because you've gotten a little state assistance, I've often seen, I applied for welfare twice under COVID. I got rejected both times, probably for my own good. But here I am thinking, I'd never apply for welfare. And then I lost my job. And I'm thinking, they've been taking 30% of my income for how many years? Yes, I'm going to get a little welfare back. So just the fact that we can't throw away all of Jeff Bezos's accomplishments of drastically increasing the availability of products and services to people at lower income levels, because yes, Amazon does work with the state. The Wright brothers, from what I know, are a couple of patent trolls who like to use the state, but come on, a couple bicycle shop owners who gave us the airplane while they were competing with, you know, the government's Langley project and they beat the government into the creation of an airplane. You can't tell me that those people aren't heroes.
Absolutely. And those people in many cases are trammeled they're trammeled by the state and their collusion with corporations and the state, because, you know, sometimes people that have great inventions, there's a vested interest in these that rests with these cartels to keep such inventions from coming to light. So those people are heroes, or would be heroes indeed. And even people that are successful, like Bezos, like Musk, you know, they've created a great deal of value, and that should be certainly appreciated. And, you know, this goes back to the idea that just because a corporation is large, that doesn't make them pernicious. That does not follow.
So it's amazing that they have come to see let's start here. When it comes to the labor theory of value, what is it from the Marxist point of view, and what is the Marxist missing?
Well, they think that all value is labor. Labor is the source of all value. So when they think that value comes directly from labor time. So if I worked 8 hours a day, I'm creating 8 hours worth of value. But the capitalist is taking 4 hours of that value and siphoning it off as surplus value that he's extracting from me at the point of production. Okay. And so it's premised on this idea that the source of all value is labor. This is obviously not true. The source of value is in the subjects who value something. It's subjective. And it is not tied to labor strictly at all. In fact, there's value that's created that takes very little labor, and there's some labor that leads to no value whatsoever.
Oh, yeah. Mila Kunis could just have an appearance, which means she physically goes to an area and could get probably $100,000, whereas I have spent a lot more hours working on this podcast and have not been fully compensated. But there's tons of labor, especially any entrepreneur will tell you that there is tons of labor that they've done that hasn't been fully compensated.
Yes.
The problem with this is that they don't focus. They say that the employer doesn't add value. They just exploit labor, even though the employer comes up with the idea of what product or service to sell, where to sell it, who to hire, how to train the employees, how to expand, how to invest resources. They literally say like the nucleus of this operation actually isn't important at all. Like, well, where would you rather be? I'm going to drop you in like any society at any time. Would you want there to be a bunch of capitalist employers competing for your value or none of these exploiters? Mm-hmm. Well, you can clearly see that when the exploiters are competing amongst each other, you're actually able to reap benefits from that.
When I was deprogramming myself and coming out of Marxism, I read Mises, and he made it very clear to me that the real people that control the productive means of production, the productive processes, are people that buy things, that people that purchase things. They are actually in control of the means of production, because it's consumers who determine what really resources will be used to what end based on their vote in the marketplace. Their purchasing of those goods. So one of the first things that's led me to realize is that, first of all, it's not the capitalist class per se that controls the means of production as such. And second of all, the main virtues of socialism are completely undermined by the fact that there is no such thing as democratic socialism, that the most democratic process is the marketplace, because there you get to vote on what you want. And under socialism, what happens is you get dictation of goods by the bureaucratic or elite class, actually, who determine what it's made, what it will cost, and on and on and on. So that it's actually the most undemocratic process imaginable. It becomes a dictatorship over production. It's a monopoly scheme. Socialism is nothing if not a monopoly scheme.
And the other fault with the labor theory of value is it means that all volunteer work should be outlawed, according to the, you know, whatever Soviet committee we end up with under communism, because volunteer work is me working for $0 an hour the benefit of someone else.
Right.
That's exploiting their labor. Libertarians, of course, see that this is totally legitimate, but it also condones things like slavery and military conscription because, hey, after all, they do get paid. You know, out of the 4.8 million soldiers in the American First World War, 2.8 million were conscripts, 116,000 deaths, to which the progressive says, well, they got paid, so it wasn't really slavery. As if compensation, you can read A Narrative Life of Frederick Douglass. He talks about how the slaves got an allowance every week or so. Anyone who would look at that and say, oh, I guess slavery wasn't bad at all. They were compensated with free food and free housing and free shelter and an allowance. A bunch of spoiled brats they were, actually. Mm-hmm. No, until you focus on the aspect of consent, none of this comes through.
They have no property in themselves, which is the first and primary and form of property on which everything else hinges. If you can't have property in yourself, you're a slave. And without property in yourself, you cannot use your labor to the ends that you want. As you know, Gene Epstein has pointed out very clearly, you're free to establish a company that's nonprofit under a free market system. You don't have to make profit. So there doesn't have to be profit making. So if you want to be a socialist, you could be a socialist under a free market system. You don't have to take profits. establish a company that is a nonprofit organization. Nobody's telling you that you can't.
Yeah, my favorite place to shop, Winco Foods, is an employee-owned organization. I also like Changing Hands Bookstore. They're, allegedly, partially employee-owned. There's nothing wrong with this at all. It's just another freedom to contract.
That's right. When
it comes to profits and losses, the Marxists will say that the worker has a right to the profits because they worked for it, and the capitalists, didn't do the work besides, coming up with the idea of what to sell and where to sell it.
Yeah.
But they never apply this to the losses. So if a company has losses, well, then the workers got to start chipping in. They say, nope, if there's losses, the workers are totally innocent because they never contracted with that.
Right.
But if there's ever profits, well, those need to be confiscated and redistributed. Where does that come from?
Yeah, that's a great one. I think it's just another hole in the Marxist edifice. It's another crack in the Marxist edifice. That is to say, they only look at the profit of corporations or companies or enterprises of any sort. And that all has to be redistributed. Losses are something that they think is just part and parcel of capitalism and proves the ruthless nature and the aleatory character of this anarchic system. And so Marx said that there'll be a number of bourgeois people with the consolidation of capital that will be pushed into the proletariat class. And so they just see this as part of the process of the ruthless nature of capitalism, that some people will utterly and miserably fail and likewise be consigned to the proletariat base.
When it comes to collective ownership or democratic decision-making, all right, so we've confiscated Amazon from Bezos, and now all of the workers own Amazon, so to speak. Well, when it comes to shortcomings and this idea of everyone getting an equal say, it doesn't even seem like this is beneficial. Ignorant people with no experience get just as much say as experienced people.
Yeah.
I barely see the benefit to collective ownership, even if their wildest dreams come true.
Yeah.
What are some of the shortcomings of collective ownership or democratic decision-making?
Well, first of all, the allocation of resources and will not be at all fruitful. It will not be productive. They'll chip away at the productive processes of society by not investing in the proper things at the right times and not producing more capital. Eventually, it eats away at the capital base because there's no person that is directing the capital towards ends of wealth production. Now it's just people, like I've said, just a very simple analogy. The economy is not a pie to be cut up and passed around. The economy is an oven for baking pies. Okay, so if you take and dismantle the oven, you have nothing. So if you take apart the capital base, then you have no engine for producing the wealth that people need. So that's the real shortcoming of it. The shortcoming of it is that capital effectively is when we talk about withering away, capital will wither away under those circumstances, and wealth production will decrease dramatically to the point of a collapse, and that's what happens.
Yeah, so I just don't see the attraction to arguments where people are like, well, it turns out, according to studies, 80% of people support this law, which is why we should expand Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, have, whatever legislation. I go, the majority of people are completely ignorant on these issues. So that's meaningless.
Right.
It's like saying 80% of the plane passengers voted to fly the cockpit this way. It's like the reason I have a really cool laptop is not because there was some democratic vote. It was Steve Jobs and a few co-conspirators with a ton of people who were just contracting with them. That's where we get the great innovative cars, airplanes, great innovations in healthcare as well. And just smash the Marxist attempt to just hate the producers and love the parasites in so many cases.
Yes.
It's just shocking. They will often say that the problem with these corporations is these corporations are self-interested. another case of them saying that's something that's technically true, but they don't grasp the implications.
Yeah.
Can you give me an example of non-self-interested people or groups on planet Earth that exist today or have ever existed?
I would see the only ones that I can think of are dead and buried, actually. There aren't any self-interested people. So even Marxists will admit this, because, you know, when they talk about the unionization or the collectivization of the labor force to wrest wages and benefits from the capitalist, that's a self-interested group. So they try to say that self-interest is evil, but then they participate in it. So they're willing to, with their own self-interest, put a gun to your head to get your wealth from you, using the state as a means by which to do it.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, every time they watch Netflix or watch YouTube and don't build houses for poor people in Haiti, they're acting in a self-interested manner, hoarding their potential social surplus from people who need it more. And it's just a sort of rational ignorance that's always going to exist. So when they say, well, we need the people to decide this through an electoral vote, well, it is so costly in time and effort to get educated about agriculture, healthcare, schooling, every single aspect. It takes so long, and you get a 1 in 10 million vote between two crooks, and God knows if the votes are even counted. No one's going to do this. It's completely ridiculous to think that any large scale democratic process is any more reasons to be skeptical of democracy or collective decision making.
Well, I mean, democracy is three people saying you ought to die, and you have one vote, and they say, you know, so they pull the trigger. That's really what it comes down to. Democracy is antithetical to liberty. It means that the majority can determine what you do and don't do. So this abrogates your rights. This abrogates your freedom utterly. It's completely antithetical to free will and liberty.
Three more questions for you. Thank you so much.
And I have one for you at the end.
Yes.
It's not going to be a tough one. It's something I have a self-interest in getting across.
Yeah. Oh, well, you're the self-interested person. I've only heard rumors of those people. I am a socialist. I want people to have income mobility in America. What do you say to me? Why should I support libertarianism if I want people to have income mobility?
You mean like upward mobility?
Correct. I want people who are poor to be able to become rich.
Yeah, that's it's just not going to happen under socialism, first of all, because it doesn't allow people to get rich, because it's taking away their so-called appropriative or exploitative capabilities from the outset. So it intends to be this great leveler, which means that there is nowhere to go. And it looks to use the state until it withers away to undertake this expropriation that leaves you incapable of rising. And the real thing is that social welfare instituted by the state actually diminishes social welfare overall. It is the opposite. It does the opposite of what it claims to do. Social welfare increases all the things that it means to mitigate, like poverty, like homelessness, like drug addiction, even like you name it, any sort of penury or debilitation. It actually produces that which it supposedly means to redress.
Okay, so we can concede that the state and its extension, socialism or the institutionalized aggression against private property, is parasitic. Mm-hmm. Why, if I want income mobility, why should I support the free market? If I want poor people to become able, if I want poor people to increase their standard of living, why should I support a free market?
Well, first of all, this is going to sound cliche, but there's more wealth produced in a free market than in a non-free market. The wealth will get produced because you have more capital accumulation. And when you have more capital accumulation and you have extended processes of production, which leads to better processes and the production of wealth, and more things become cheaper and cheaper and cheaper when they're not interfered with, of course, by the federal government, the state, or the central bank. So we would have a vast increase of wealth if not for the state and central banking. It would be incredible. And, you know, a rising tide does lift all boats. That's very cliche, but it's just true.
Yes, certainly. And the examples of South Korea, North Korea, East and West Germany, we see this all the time. The more access to a free market, the better the average person is. Finally, one of the objections that socialist statists constantly have is, who protects the worker and the consumer in a market economy? How do you answer that?
Well, what happens is, in a market economy, there's self-protection by virtue of the fact that there's free contracts. So you can dissolve a contract in the free market at any time. If you find that you think that you're being exploited, or you could do better in a different position or a different company, you're free to do that. If you think you could do better by being an entrepreneur, you're free to do so. So that's who protects it. What protects it is your own self-interest, actually. And without some interference, without intervention, your self-interest is allowed to operate freely. But under interventionism, under statism, your self-interest is not allowed to operate freely. You're robbed of proceeds of your production. You're robbed of your freedom. And you're robbed you're robbed of property rights to begin with. And if it goes all the way to full statist communism, you're robbed of the property in yourself altogether.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. What is your question for me?
I've been told by some people, I won't name names, that it is not necessary for a candidate for president as a libertarian to be able to articulate things like this, that it's not necessary to talk to them about Rothbard or talk to them about Hans Hermann Hoppe, that they're too stupid to understand it anyway, that we can't. That's not our role. Our role is to basically spit slogans and get them attracted by virtue of our charisma and whatever. What do you think about that?
Well, I think spitting slogans or any bumper stickers can certainly attract people. What I think will really ignite the class consciousness that we need to ignite is a proper understanding of the ideas of Ludwig von Mises. So explaining things like in his book, Planning for Freedom, just keeping these messages alive, that wages rise as a result of competition and capital investment. Anyone who can make that cool, that is someone
That's what
we need. Anyone who can, you know, take Rothbard's Anatomy of the State and summarize it in one or two sentences, I think that'll be much more likely to create a lasting effect. People who at least will hear the definition of capitalism, socialism, and communism as described by Hoppe in A Theory of Capitalism and Socialism.
Yes.
That is so vitally important. So bumper stickers absolutely will attract people, and that might be how they remember it. But the reason that this takeover of the LP was so vitally important is so we could actually spread these ideas to as many people as possible. And that, of course, is why, just having looked into you and I met in Chicago, right when I looked into you, I said, look, he's the guy that can keep Mises, Rothbard, Hoppe, and Bastiat and Spooner alive. That's who I'm going with. So, yes, I do think it is vitally important, not just to attract people, but to keep them long term.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. That's what I think, too. I think it's necessary to be able to articulate these things to people and to know them intimately and really understand them. And I also think, having been a Marxist, this actually gives me an advantage. It's not a disadvantage, because it allows me to know what these people think, what their premises are, and and then having the education in the Austrian school, and what's wrong with them. Why are they so fatally flawed? And thank you for this exercise, because it's very good.
Remind us of where to go if we want to support the campaign.
Wrecktheregime.com. That's RECtheregime.com, one word. Or you can go to Rechtenwald2024.com, but I like Wreck the Regime. It will get you to the same place.
Thanks to everyone for watching Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone. Dr. Rechtenwald, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure, Keith. Thanks for having me.